From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live.
With Ben O'Shea. Brought to you by the WA Local Government Association. What's your happy place?
One of Perth's most exclusive boys' schools is trying to stop its students from getting trapped in a man box. Now I know what you're thinking. What the heck is a man box? Well, the character education director at Aquinas College reckons the man box is a metaphorical space a lot of blokes get pigeonholed in. And that happens because of stereotypes around masculinity that force a lot of young men to act a certain way. When those young men become adult men, that behaviour can be so ingrained they never break out of the man box. It creates pressure on men to be tough, to not show emotions, be the breadwinner, always be in control, and, in the worst cases, use violence to solve problems and think of women as inferior. It's not hard to see how the man box causes problems in society. The question, of course, is whether an Aquinas College program that gets Year 9 boys to dance on stage in front of 700 people will fix the problem. But you know what? Maybe it won't, but recognising the problem is one heck of a good start. Coming up on the show, the new WA boss of the AMA has called for over 50s to get the Pfizer jab. Is it a good idea? Plus, why a minimum wage hike might not be good for everyone. And we'll cross live to the Extinction Rebellion protest in the city. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now in the studio, Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. Hey, mate.
Ben, happy Friday Eve.
It must have been pretty frosty when you came to work at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It was chilly this morning, but you know, as does happen, it gets colder as you get closer to the time of sunrise.
Yeah,
so it's actually warmer when I come
in
the middle of the
night. It was cold when I came in, let me tell you.
You're still recovering.
And now talking about people coming in, Western Australians and other people who are arriving from New South Wales are now going to be subject to some COVID protocols.
Yes, they've been ordered to get tested and to quarantine for 14 days from their date of exposure. This is if they've been to any of the exposure sites over in New South Wales, and there's more than a dozen of them. This is all in response to Sydney recording two positive cases. So there's a lot of testing going on in the Bondi area. It's a very popular area for tourists. So the WA Health Authorities are very keen for anybody who's been to New South Wales to check those exposure sites, check the list on the government website. If you've been there, go and get tested. Even if you haven't been there and you have been to New South Wales, just monitor for symptoms, and if you start to get a fever, get a cough, go and get tested as well.
I know they're doing genomic testing of those positive cases. Do we know anything about how this has happened?
Don't know how it's leaked out at the moment. We've seen many times, haven't we, where it's leaked out of hotel quarantine and there's, you know, can be an exchange between people inside hotel quarantine, also with, you know, security staff, etc. A lot of them have now been vaccinated, of course. So you would hope that that would provide some sort of protection, more protection than there was before.
And also, of course, we had an outbreak south of the border in Victoria, so there's every chance that it's come from there. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
That's the thing. It's all very connected over there. We have the, you know, the great advantage of distance and, you know, the fact that we can shut the border or get a little stricter than some of the other states are prepared to get to.
Well, let's talk about WA because whenever there's an outbreak, obviously we start talking about vaccination, and we know over here and really around the country, the over 50s aren't that keen to roll up the sleeve if the only jab they can get is AstraZeneca.
Yeah, they don't want it.
And there's been a push for Pfizer.
Push for Pfizer. So the Australian Medical Association's new WA president says WA should go against those national guidelines and give those aged 50 to 59 the Pfizer jab. Because of the vaccine hesitancy at the moment, because of that very, very slim, rare chance of a blood clot from the AstraZeneca happening, our you know, new top doctor says just give them the Pfizer, prioritise the 50s getting the Pfizer as opposed to giving it to those in their 20s next up, for example. So it'll be interesting to see what the government does on this. Of course, it was agreed at National Cabinet for people aged 40 to 49 to get the Pfizer jab, and then WA went a step further and against the national guidelines and gave it to people aged 30 to 49. So our new top doctor is saying, look, go against against the guidelines again, get those aged 50 to 59 vaccinated instead of them sitting at home waiting around for a Pfizer jab, which, you know, they don't really know when they could get it.
Yeah. Well, I've had emails from people all the time about this in that over 50s range. And one woman said to me that her and all her friends would happily pay to get the Pfizer jab if it was made available to them. And I think that could be a good little money spinner. Get the boomers paying $100.
What would you use the proceeds for?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Okay.
I have to think about that. But it's interesting though, isn't it? Like, it's why shouldn't you be allowed to pay for it?
Well, that's it.
If you know, if they're not going to give it to you,
it's to do with the availability of the vaccine.
Yeah. If it's sitting around.
Yeah. If it's sitting there and it's just going to go to waste and be thrown out, why not?
Yeah. I think they should give people a choice.
But the problem is, if we do one, this is what happens. We've done one thing here with the 30 to 39 year olds, and it's not happening over East, and those over East are whinging about it, and they might not have the same availability of Pfizer to be able to do that sort of thing. Mm. So you get this inequity.
Hello, tourism opportunity.
Could you imagine? Climb the Matagarrup Bridge and get vaccinated with Pfizer here in WA.
Yeah.
And Mark McGowan's at the airport welcoming you, you know.
Yeah, I tell you what, it makes sense. And now, does a wave park in Perth make sense?
Speaking of tourism.
That's the question, I think, that has been asked for a number of years now. No one has really come to an answer.
Not yet, but there's a new contender. So we saw the wave park that was going to be constructed in the city of Melville absolutely flop. Now there's a new contender for Perth's first wave park, and it's in the northern suburbs, the city of Stirling. So it's been revealed the city's had preliminary discussions with two proponents. You know, this could progress. The site that they're looking at potentially is between the Stirling administration building, the council administration building, you know, with the big sculpture out the front, and the Mitchell Freeway. So it used to be used for landfill up until the 1970s, before my time.
Just sort of big hills of grass now.
Just near where they have the markets on the weekend.
They've
had circus.
The Moscow
there.
Circus.
Yeah, they've all come to town. So that's where they're thinking. It's probably a good, I mean, it's a really good spot because it's close to the freeway. And if the waves are better at Scarborough, you can just keep going on. At this stage, it's just very preliminary. Don't get too excited. I do find it quite unusual, though, that, you know, places like Melbourne have wave parks.
I've never been to an artificial wave park.
There's one in Melbourne. If you, as you drive between Melbourne Airport and the city, there's a wave park there towards Essendon Airport. I mean, there's about 2 days of the year where anyone would want to get out in the elements with a surfboard in Melbourne. In Perth, where there are many days, we don't have one.
Well, you do and have
we
to do, wonder.
We have very flat waves a lot of the time.
But
in Perth, it's not like down south. It's not like pumping down Margaret River. If you go to Trigg, you know, people are struggling on a half metre wave.
And the irony is, it would probably get used more in the summer than the winter, because the summer is when the waves usually are not that great.
Yeah, because how's it go? I'm getting really young. I was about to sound like a surfer, and then I really tripped myself off. It's either onshore or offshore.
We're both going to be just revealed as total.
They blow onto the shore. Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. I think it's the easterlies, because they're the warm easterlies.
Mate, I can tell. Yeah, I can tell flat. You regularly hang 10.
I'm going to have to ask Rick about this later on, because I know he goes to
Trigg
often. I'll ask Rick. But yeah, that's how it works. The winds blow onto the shore or off of the shore.
All right, we'll come back to this later in the week.
In any case, as you said, in summertime, the waves are terrible in
that's
Perth.
Right. Yeah. We got there in the end.
Can we edit? Are we live, are we?
No, this is live. This is live radio. Thanks, Matty. All right, mate. We'll talk to you on the West Live tomorrow.
We'll do. Have a good one.
You're listening to The West Live.
And now we're going to head live to that Extinction Rebellion protest. As 7 News reporter Cassidy Moscone joins me now. G'day, Cassidy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well.
It's quite noisy there in the background. Can you tell us what's going on?
It is. So right now there's about 20 or so Extinction Rebellion protesters outside the exhibition centre along Mount Spey Road. Now, there's drummers, there's singers, but the main disruption today is they've parked a truck to the entrance of the exhibition centre. And why they've targeted here? That's because one of the biggest oil and gas conferences in the country is taking place. It's been going on since Monday. They've had a presence here, Extinction Rebellion, since then, but today is the last day of the conference, so it's the crescendo of their action.
Yeah, right. So they've actually parked a truck in the entryway to the car park, so people can't come in. Is that what's happening?
Yep, no one's going in, no one's going out. And sitting on top of that truck is two protesters, and they've been handed move-on notices from police, but they're not going away anytime soon. I've got the drummers coming right up the stairs now, so you can probably hear that getting louder. There's a heavy police presence, though. They've blocked off the intersection as well, trying to make it as safe as they can. I haven't seen any arrests yet, but hey, with those move-on notices, if they don't get out of there, I'm sure it's only a matter of time.
And what is everybody on their morning commute thinking? Because it's right there at the bus station. Are people looking quite quizzical at this protest?
Yeah, it's fair to say the traffic's moving a little slower than usual around here. It's a peak hour, but that's not exactly what you want. But it's definitely grabbed the attention that they were after, you can say that.
Yeah, right. And sometimes these Extinction Rebellion protests can get a little bit wild. What's the atmosphere like at this one? Is it all fairly amicable?
Yeah, there's no fighting or anything like that. It's a lot of music, it's a lot of yelling, but of course there's that huge inconvenience for the public and of course the police. And looking at them right now, they're actually backing the paddy wagon up to the truck, so it might look like there'll be a bit of action here soon.
Yeah, right. It does look like the police will probably want to clear them out soon. Have the police given you any indication of whether they would move in?
Yes, they've told us that if people don't respond to their orders, those move on notices, that they will make arrests. You can definitely get the sense of their frustration. They said they've been here every day of this oil and gas conference. Today's obviously the biggest demonstration that they've done, but police, they do seem frustrated as, it's a lot of resources to have down here for these actions.
Mm. Well, we'll watch along closely on Channel 7 News to find out what exactly is going on. 7 News reporter Cassidy Moscone, thanks for joining me on The West Live.
Thank you.
There have been renewed calls to give over 50s the Pfizer vaccine, with WA's new AMA president calling on the state government to go against national guidelines and prioritise over 50s before giving West Aussies in their 20s the Pfizer vaccine. Joining me now to unpack this suggestion is infectious diseases physician and microbiologist Professor Paul Griffin. Welcome back to the show, Paul.
Thanks for having me again.
And so what do you make of this idea that the 50s to 59s are more vulnerable to COVID-19, so let's give them the Pfizer jab before we open it up to the 20s to 29s?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpick there. I mean, I guess the first thing to say is I don't think it's necessarily productive to suggest undermining the national advice, which is based on genuine expert advice from the ATAGI, the group that advised the TGA, who are comprised of a lot of, genuine experts in this area and are making decisions based on best evidence. So I think that in itself is a little bit disappointing. And, we can debate the best groups to use which vaccine in, but the key thing here is the AstraZeneca vaccine remains a safe and effective vaccine in the group in which we're using it. And so if we were to prioritise Pfizer in that group, it would mean we would have to compromise on our vaccination of other groups. And if we reduce our ability to vaccinate those people in their 20s and 30s, for example, well, they're a group that actually are responsible for a lot of transmission of the virus. So if we pivot against that advice and use the precious resource perhaps inappropriately, then I think we're going to leave ourselves very vulnerable moving forward.
Mm, I think that's a very interesting point to make, because now that's what we're seeing around the world, isn't it? That even though this younger cohort might not be at as much risk to end up in hospital with COVID, they certainly seem to be the ones who are spreading it the quickest.
That's exactly right. We know that those people, through certain behaviours and other things, are responsible for a vast majority of the transmission. So while it's certainly correct that the older you are, the more likely you are of bad consequences from the infection, we also need to do something to reduce the spread of the virus. And I think if people suggest, oh, well, let's just wait for an alternative, there are real risks of waiting as well. And we've seen that unfold in other countries like Taiwan, for example, where COVID came back with a vengeance. And then it's very hard to catch up your vaccination campaign while the virus is raging in the population. And to a lesser extent, of course, but in a similar sort of principle, we saw that recently in Victoria. So we really do need to get cracking with the vaccination campaign. campaign to make sure we're protected and don't have to rely on lockdowns and border restrictions.
I guess the tough thing, though, is you and me have spoken many times about the, you know, how rare the blood clotting is with the AstraZeneca vaccine. But the reality now is that the brand AstraZeneca has been tainted, and to what degree, I guess, might vary from one state to the next. But here in Western Australia, I'll tell you this story that I was told yesterday by someone who went to the mass vaccination centre in Claremont, and the Pfizer vaccination area, absolutely chock-a-block. Like, it was line after line after line of people waiting to roll up their sleeve. And the other section where people were getting the AstraZeneca vaccine, a couple of people.
Yeah, and that's why I think, you know, messaging like we're hearing at the moment is potentially fueling that rather than addressing it. I think we really do need to work on getting the messaging right. I mean, I think there's so many misconceptions about that vaccine. There are still people that talk about it being inferior in terms of how it works, and we know that's just simply not the case. And yes, it's clear it has an adverse event that's very unfortunate, and we'd love a vaccine that doesn't have any, but unfortunately that doesn't exist. And Pfizer also has adverse events related to it. But the key thing here is this expert group, ATAGI and the TGA, continuously monitor adverse events of all vaccines, both locally and abroad. And if at any stage those events mean that the risks outweigh the benefits, well, then they simply wouldn't use the vaccine. So I think for one area to suggest that they would like to deviate from that advice potentially fuels the negative messaging around that vaccine rather than addresses it.
Mm. And do you think when the AMA comes out and says that that's something that needs to happen, does it show that maybe there is a schism that exists, I guess, in the medical community over how to proceed with the vaccine rollout?
I think it can. I think it can certainly lead to people having less confidence in those people that are making the decisions, because I guess they wonder why certain people are saying things that do seem against the expert advice, when the majority of us are saying we should have faith in that advice and trust that regulatory body that, you know, whose sole responsibility it is to ensure that we only use safe and effective vaccines and medicines. And, you know, it's clear it's not in their interest to allow a vaccine to be used if it wasn't very clear that the benefits outweighed those risks. And, you know, the other thing about AstraZeneca is it's one we can make locally, so we're less susceptible to the supply constraints that we still see with Pfizer. So again, if people are saying they're going to wait for an alternative, they might be waiting a very long time.
Because talking to people, it does seem not so much about a fear of AstraZeneca, it's about, I guess, the being disgruntled about not having a choice.
Yeah, and I completely understand that, but I guess the thing people need to realise there is that we simply don't have enough of these vaccines yet. Obviously, we're still in a global pandemic, and manufacturing is exceeded by supply at the moment. So, you know, it would be great to potentially have 50 million doses of Pfizer on shore, but it's just not going to happen. And it's great that we now have Novavax coming soon and Moderna, but again, you know, those vaccines will be subject to supply constraints as well. So, you know, AstraZeneca is the one we have the most ready access to, because it can be made on shore, and so I think we need to be really careful in anything that undermines that the use of that vaccine, because, you know, as I say, it's very clear that the benefits still outweigh those risks.
Well, the benefits, of course, are in preventing future outbreaks. And there's one over on your side of the country that we're watching very closely, a source of community transmission in Bondi after a man in his 60s tested positive. How concerning is that?
I think we don't necessarily have to be unduly concerned. I think what's clear is this virus will keep coming, and unless we completely stop anybody coming into the country, which of course is not realistic and not suggesting that happens, but if people are allowed to return, the virus will keep coming. And that's why, you know, I certainly think we need to focus on doing our best to prevent transmission through other mechanisms and hotel quarantine or other quarantine facilities. But still, our best protection from uncontrolled community spread is high rates of vaccination. So again, that's why I think, you know, that needs to be a focus moving forward.
Mm. And would you back calls for the business community to get involved in incentivising people to get the jab?
I think we need to look at everything possible to try and improve our vaccine uptake. I think the messaging, consistent messaging that addresses some of these concerns is very important. I think certain incentives need to be considered. The other thing that I feel strongly about is I think we need to start linking freedoms to people that are vaccinated. For example, if there are restrictions, travel restrictions in place, then I think people that are fully vaccinated should potentially be able to be exempt from those and maybe have shorter quarantine periods and things like that, for example, because we know the vaccine works, we know it protects people, and so I think we need to acknowledge that in changing some of those restrictions for people that are fully protected.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing some of that strategy work well overseas, where, of course, they have more of an issue with COVID in their communities. Here, where we don't have it as much, there are plenty of people who think, well, I'm already free. I already can walk around, do whatever I want. But international travel is an interesting one, isn't it? And do you back the Prime Minister Scott Morrison in establishing a, say, travel bubble with Singapore?
I do, and particularly when we know we have these effective vaccines that greatly reduce people's risk, then I think that with other mitigation strategies and obviously watching the situation on both sides and, you know, of course, if there was a sharp rise in community transmission, maybe reassessing, you know, as we've done with New Zealand. But I think we do need to start making some inroads in getting some of those things back. And I think travel bubbles with countries with good control in people who are fully vaccinated is something we should certainly start doing.
Over here in Western Australia, we reduced the number of people we're bringing in from overseas, Australians who are returning home, because there were some concerns over our hotel quarantine system. The Premier here is keen to establish a standalone facility. Who pays for it, of course, is the sticking point at the moment. Do you think that's inevitable if we're looking at how long we might be in this pandemic and having to bring people home or open the borders, bring people in, that things like standalone facilities are something that governments should be looking at?
I do. I think that it's something that makes sense, and not only for us to have strategies for the current pandemic and the situation right now, but also for us to have capacity moving forward. I mean, this pandemic itself, unfortunately, is not going away in the coming months or perhaps even years. And so we do need to have capacity to bring people back safely. And of course, it may be something we can use in future pandemics or to control other things. So I think it would be a very wise investment and something that probably shouldn't be delayed, because every day that it's delayed, I guess we're reducing the potential benefit from having that capacity. So, but I think we also need to remember it's not a silver bullet. I mean, we've seen obviously someone who was transporting people from overseas potentially still get infected. So we still need to look at how we get people in and out and how we look after them there. But I do think it's something we should have.
Infectious diseases physician and microbiologist Paul Griffin, thanks for joining me on The West Live.
Thank you.
Now, the Fair Work Commission yesterday announced some of the country's lowest paid workers will receive a pay rise of 2.5%, or about $18 a week. But for some businesses who are just scraping by, the Australian Hotels Association reckons this could put extra pressure on already struggling hospitality businesses and are calling on the government to lift restrictions, especially around COVID, when the pay increase comes into effect later this year. Joining me now is the king of hospitality in the CBD. He owns Varnish, Hedika and Caballitos, to name a few, Andy Freeman. Andy, thanks for joining me on the show.
Morning, Ben. How are you, mate?
Yeah, doing really good, buddy. Now, what was your reaction when you heard this news from the Fair Work Commission yesterday?
I guess conflicted, because we love our staff and always really want to look after everyone, and they're entitled to more, then that's fantastic. But it just comes at a obviously pretty precarious time for our industry. We've been at half capacity or less for over 12 months. It's a long road. We're not out the other end of it. So the timing is pretty bad.
Yeah, right. And so what impact is it going to have on you to increase the wages?
I mean, that compounded with the super increase, you know, we're a medium business, I guess. So we've got over 100 staff. It's quite a lot of money. And all of our overheads are still at full whack. Our rent, the price of beer or of insurance, everything else is full except for our ability to trade at full capacity, which is half. So it's going to definitely put a dent in our fender. We've been minimising any of our risk, I guess, for the last 12 months just to survive. we're not out buying jet skis or doing anything crazy. It's a pretty conservative life the last 12 months. And being in the city, double with half our hotels being ISO hotels and no international tourists or travel, it's compounding, and it's going to be definitely a challenge.
Well, let me just quickly do the maths in my head here for people listening along at home. So you're trading at about 50% capacity because of impacts of COVID, and you're paying 100% of what you'd normally pay in your rents and your overheads.
Correct.
And now you're going to have to pay 2.5% more across your 100 or so staff in wages, which I'm sure adds up. And then with the super increase, that's probably an extra 0.5%. So let's say about 3% increase in wages.
Correct.
So, so I'm no maths genius, but that to me says that that the pie the pie of revenue that you have for your business just had a slice taken out of it.
Yeah, you know, we don't even trade as many hours or as many days as we did a year ago. Fridays and Mondays, I think people are working from home in the city, so the city's a lot quieter on those days, which is another new problem. So, yeah, it's we're right in the middle, the eye of the storm, I guess, and just trying to get through. Grateful that we are in WA, one of the most livable cities in the world. So, you know, what a testament. And we've done a great job to come out of COVID better than most. But, yeah, that, you know, this Fair Work announcement, just bad timing, I guess.
And so what would you like to see? Would you like to see some sort of commitment from the state government that, you know, they would relax some of the COVID restrictions, or at least give you some certainty that if there was you know, some sort of an outbreak or some sort of change, that you'd still be allowed to trade?
Mate, 100%. You know, it's fair to say the snap lockdowns kill us, because we've got rosters, we've got functions that we have to refund, fridges and cool rooms full of stock that then just go in the bin with little to no warning. Safe to assume the government probably has a few game plans. If A happens, this is what we'll do. If B happens, this is what we'll do. So having some visibility on their roadmap of intentions would definitely help us mitigate, you know, some of the risk. And then obviously being at half capacity, but seeing some other arenas and things being able to trade a bit bigger is pretty tough for us. We've still been paying rent. Everything we're doing is business as usual as on the surface, but we're ducks on water with legs scrambling for survival underneath. So it's definitely challenging. More visibility, Ben. Yes, 100%.
Yeah, right. So when you see, you know, 50,000+ people at Optus Stadium, and your business is trading at 50%, it's pretty hard to watch.
It's a pretty tough pill to swallow, you know. And I appreciate that our country, a big part of it is we love our footy, and that's great, and no objection to any of that. I just think we should all be in the same weight division, and if they're allowed to do that, then why aren't the small guys as well? It just seems fair.
Well, let's talk about CBD workers, because I spoke about this on the show earlier this week, that with some of the city's biggest employers, your Chevrons and those sort of players, are encouraging their staff to work from home a couple of days a week. So you've noticed the impact of that on your businesses.
Mate, it's funny. I was late for work on Friday, and so for me, I was on the road at 8:15. And it was the fastest run I've had in from northern suburbs into the city that I've had in weeks. And I'm normally on the road at about 7:15. So it just supported my hunch that no one is in the city on a Friday. There was no traffic. And I have met with the city, and you know, we're working through that, because it's not just me. It's a lot of my colleagues are finding the same trend. And, I mean, I can understand working from home could be attractive, and if you are going to choose a day, logically, you'd think it would be a Friday or a Monday, so you sort of had that long weekend and get some stuff done while you're there. But for me, mate, Friday's payday. Friday is the big day in the city, traditionally, and it's definitely changed. It's definitely a new trend.
Well, I said this week that, you know, obviously Lord Mayor Basil Zemplis, a colleague of mine here at Seven West Media, is now the Lord Mayor of Perth, and he's embarked on this campaign to come up with a new brand for Perth, to how to figure out what Perth is and how we sell it to the East Coast, how we sell it to the rest of the world. And I made the point that maybe what we need to do is first sell it to the people of Perth so we get those CBD workers coming back in. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah. Mate, I think so. You know, Perth brand identity, it's been going on. That's been a long conversation on before Baz was in the city. And I'm talking to him with my thoughts too to try and offer some assistance. But I just think it's traditionally Friday, you stay after work, you stay and play. You don't come into the city, you know. You've finished a long day of work, you're in your work clothes, you go home. Saturday night is the night where you get dressed, you get a cab, you get the babysitter, and you come into the city. So if Fridays have dipped, and if my theory is correct, it is from people working from home, particularly from the big towers, then we do need to create something attractive, something that's inviting, lower the barriers, which would be parking or public transport costs, or add some more value in the businesses and in the city to encourage people to come in. And then it's up to those big guys, the big companies that are either, you know, driven by global and national mandates as to they have to work from home, and they're still driven by what happens in America and et cetera, et cetera. But Perth is a bubble, and we need to sort of crack on and try and get back to where we were 12, 18 months ago as soon as we can, because we can't keep sustaining this sort of, you know, death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
Quite frustrating.
And do you reckon it is those CBD businesses that have copped it the worst? Because we know, you know, the Wander Out Yonder has generated a lot of revenue for a lot of businesses in regional WA. CBD hotels, we know, have not fared nearly as well. Do you think there's something that maybe a little bit more help needs to be done here from the state government? Because we know we're getting a lot of new roads built. We're getting a lot of money thrown around. Is the CBD getting enough?
I mean, I can only talk for myself and from what I see and what I feel. The city is definitely suffering, and undoubtedly it'll turn around. And our logic with our investment was the city will always be the city, if that makes any sense. It's always going to be the city. So I always thought, well, that's smart. Let's get in there and let's do something. It has pushed to the suburbs with Westfields, and, you know, coastal things are very inviting, I guess, during a pandemic where you want to feel healthy and be a bit more outdoors. But yeah, definitely the state government's got to support the city a bit more, give us a bit more visibility of their roadmap of intentions if we do get any more blips, and hopefully we can track out of it by Christmas.
And what about that that brand Perth idea, Andy? You said that it's been around, it predates Baz, we know that. It's been something that's been talked about for many years, probably the whole time you've been running venues in Perth. Are we any closer to figuring it out? And do you think there is something to figure out?
Yeah, it's a funny one, mate. You know, and I've spoken to a few people about it, and I always think Perth is Australia's best kept secret. The people of Perth know the secrets, the best spots, where to get that great coffee, where's that favourite secluded beach or that cute little restaurant or something. But Perth people don't like to share. I think whereas Melbourne and Sydney have always chanted from the treetops as to what they've got and where to find it, whereas Perth people kind of like it. I like our quietness, to be fair. You know, for me and my family, I love it. I love travelling, but I love coming home. So it really is sort of breaking that mentality of what we've been doing for so long. We've grown up very quickly over the last 10 or 15 years too. I think a lot of these other cities have grown up gradually over a greater amount of time. So they've developed who they are and their identity, whereas Perth just sprouted. It's really exciting, but yeah, that brand needs to catch up, and I think the people of Perth need to get behind it, because for us, our nighttime economy and guys like me and Yagan Square and all these new hotels that are planned, we need to get people over here, so we can't keep hiding behind our curtain or our iron gate. There's a bit of work to get done.
Exactly. We've got plenty of iron ore to build that gate. And now, mate, I'm going to let you go. But before I do, because you're a pretty optimistic fella, given everything that's going on and the doom and gloom around, you're opening a new venue, your partnership with Pirate Life, that I know a lot of people, especially craft beer enthusiasts, are very excited about. Can you give me any news on that one?
Mate, it's been probably, to be fair, maybe a three-year project. I hit the big stop button when COVID hit, because obviously our toes were on the end of a cliff and we didn't know what the world was going to look like in a day, an hour, a week or a month. But the boys have been back at it 6 days a week, and we're full on going to get that baby open. But when is the question? And I need this Pfizer vaccine to start moving, consumer confidence to come up. I need the city to get busy, because that venue will bring on about another 60 people. Employment is challenging. Hospitality isn't the sexy business that it once was. I think for the kids, it's seen as risky, and the casuals are the first ones to suffer. So when I close, salary staff might have some holiday accrual, but the casuals, they just don't get paid. So there's a lot of work that's got to get done around me for us to open the brewery. But we will get open this year, and we can't wait. It's going to be the biggest hospitality investment the city's seen for years. And the partnership with Pipelife, it's just a radical brand. It really resonates with our company, Sneakers and Jeans. We've already got our first beers already in production and available out there in the market. So I can't tell you too much because, you know, we're a bit of a marketing business and we would like to build the sizzle reel. But before you know it, it'll be in the city and everyone will be talking about it. We'll get you down there for a beer, Ben.
Oh, mate, fantastic. And in the meantime, I'll be having plenty of beers at your many other wonderful venues. Andy Freeman,
appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me on The West Live.
Good on you, mate. Bye.
Now, WA's museum, Boola Bardup, opened in the middle of a pandemic. And while we can't go over to Greece, a bit of Greece is coming to us. Ancient Greece, that is. Joining me now to give us a glimpse into the WA Museum's first international exhibition is the Minister for Culture and the Arts, David Templeman. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, mate. It's great to join you this morning.
And so, how exciting is this?
Well, what a magnificent exhibition. Our first international exhibition in Boola Bardup that we'll have is going to be a spectacular ancient Greek athletes, warriors and heroes exhibition coming to WA. It's from the British Museum. It's the largest display of objects and stories drawn from the British Museum's classic Greek collection. It's a great relationship that Boola Bardup has with the British Museum. And we're the first port of call in Australia for this spectacular exhibition, and it'll open on Sunday.
How fantastic is that? And when we committed, the WA government committed hundreds of millions of dollars to building this new museum, this is what we had in mind, isn't it? Bringing some of the world's best touring exhibitions to Perth.
Well, we spectacularly opened the new museum, of course, in November last year. And the first exhibition, quite appropriately, was the Seven Sisters exhibition, which, of course, was a spectacular Indigenous exhibition, enjoyed by thousands and thousands of people who came through the museum for the first time. This is our second but first international exhibition. And it's really important that our museum, Boola Bardup, showcases high-quality, world-class exhibitions from around the world. And this one, I think ancient Greece, ancient Rome, those always intrigue people. And I think we're going to expect a lot of people are going to be very interested in coming and having a look at this ancient Greek exhibition at Boola Bardup.
Do you know much about some of the pieces in this exhibition, some of the highlights?
Well, the fantastic thing is it's, as I said, the largest range ever assembled or loaned by the British Museum. And the selections are vast and diverse, ranging from exquisite gold jewellery, iconic black and red ceramics that, of course, show the images of athletes, gods, citizens are going about their daily lives, then through to stunning marble and terracotta statues, bronze figurines, weapons and armour that were used in conflict, and through to children's toys, games, and of course, the Greek coins. So it's a very diverse collection. And one of the truly exceptional objects, I think, is some objects that form part or once part of the mausoleum of Halicarnassus. And that was one of the original seven ancient wonders of the world. So people will see some artifacts from one of the original seven ancient wonders of the world here in Perth.
Wow, pretty amazing. And for people who don't know, how do we even get such an exhibition to Perth? Does the WA government have to dip into its coffers to bring something like that over here?
Well, part of the budget of the new museum is, of course, to ensure that our temporary gallery, and that's the gallery that houses these visiting exhibitions, have product in them. And so there's negotiations with the relevant sources of these exhibitions. We have a very good relationship, of course, with the British Museum, which is revered worldwide for its collection. And of course, our director of the museum, Alec Cole, is a previous employee with the British Museum as well. So we've got some great connections. And I think the exciting thing is we're the first port of call in Australia where this Greek ancient Greek exhibition lands. So it's a unique opportunity for all Western Australians and visitors to our state to truly experience a remarkable exhibition. I think they'll be stunned.
Mm. And going forward, obviously things are a bit tricky at the moment with COVID, but is the idea that we will, I guess, be competing with other museums around the world to get these travelling exhibitions and potentially have them exclusively for Australia, and then that becomes a tourism draw card for WA?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of our aims, is to utilise what is a stunning award-winning museum. And as you'd probably be aware, this Boulevardip Museum has already collected nearly a dozen awards, including international awards, for its spectacular, the spectacular nature that it is. So we want to showcase our new museum by, of course, having high-quality touring exhibitions, and part of that is attracting them to Perth so that West Australian and visiting audiences from interstate, and ultimately when it's safe to do so internationally, will come and see these world-class exhibitions here in Perth. And that, of course, has huge benefits for the tourism industry, for hospitality, and continues to put Western Australia on the map and in the minds of people interstate and internationally.
Yeah, fantastic. And so the exhibition opens on Sunday, did you say?
Opens on Sunday, the 20th of June, through, and is there in our temporary exhibition site for several months through to Sunday, 7th of November. It is obviously a ticketed exhibition, but well worth it. And there's some good packages for people to come along and enjoy this wonderful international exhibition.
Yeah, pretty special opportunity. Probably won't get a chance to go to the British Museum anytime soon. Minister for Culture and the Arts, David Templeman, thanks for joining us again on The West Live.
Great to join you on West Live. Thank you.
Mark Duffy.
By golly gosh.
And Glenn Quarterman.
Wow-wee.
Together, they are Duff and Quarters.
You know who?
Together they are Duff and Quarters. Separately, they're either Duff or Quarters. And today, I've got Quarters, Glenn Quartermain, Sunday Times sports editor. G'day, mate.
How are you, Ben? All right?
Good, good. You've given your partner in crime the week off?
Oh, he's having a well-earned break, of course. We've got buys for both Freo and West Coast this weekend, so having a well-earned break. I will be joined on the podcast by Golden Tonsils Skeeter Reddings,
Mark Reddings.
Very much a part of the triumvirate now. So
yeah, he is.
And despite the fact we do have two buys, there's plenty to talk about this weekend.
Well, I was going to say, we won't be talking about the local teams. Where do you want to start?
Well, some pretty big tribunal hearing tonight in Melbourne. David McKay of the Adelaide Crows is up. It's been referred directly to the tribunal. I had a story today. Brett Farmer's bought into the entire argument. Now, this has pretty well divided the footy world. I think there's genuinely David McKay was attacking the football, but there comes a point where you accelerate, you turn, your shoulder hits an opponent's head. Hunter Clark has three fractures to his jaw, won't be playing for 8 weeks, if again this season. So I think we've come to a point where we've all wrestled with this, and I certainly believe that we need to take accidental contact now out of the game. So we've sort of been debating it for a few years now. The AFL's been very vague on it. Some players get suspended, others don't, and it's a really fine line. I think we need to legislate at the end of this year, but it'll be really interesting to see. By the letter of the law, McKay may get off tonight, but the AFL really want to give him a minimum of 3 weeks. They'll argue that it is unreasonable contact, and that McKay, that Hunter Clark could have expected to contest that ball and not had that contact. So Brett Farmer, the son of Polly, I spoke to him last night. Now, the Farmers don't often comment. When they do, it really resonates, and he believes it's time. A really interesting line from Brett was that it's time to stop treating them as our opponents and start treating them as fellow footballers. So I think what he means by that is it's still a contest very much, but we've got to make the head sacrosanct. Certainly in marking contests, you can still go for your marks and have those great marks. But I think if it's a loose ball on the ground and you're both going for the footy, I think it's time to stop these accelerations and high hits, because look, we're going to lose future footballers because parents won't want their kids playing the game.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. There's a lot to unpack here, because the AFL has publicly said over and over again that they're very serious about player safety. We know, we've seen what's happened in American football with the issues around concussion and what they're doing to stamp out those head-high contacts. And they don't make a deliberate or accidental distinction. If you make contact with the head, you're in trouble. They don't have a suspension system the way we do here. And you just get an on-field penalty that can be quite severe sometimes. Do you think that there'd be a sliding scale of penalty?
Absolutely.
So even if you just assume that even an accidental head contact is going to be, that's a punishable offence. But do you how then do you grade it?
Oh, look, it'll be graded as similar now. Severity of contact, intent, all those things will still come into it. But I think if it is contact with the head, it's going to have to be punished, and by at least a week. You've got to stop footballers. You've got to make them think stop, prop and tackle, rather than accelerate into another opponent when it's a ground ball, I think. The really interesting part of it is the NRL has been really, really hard on head-high contacts this year, and their chairman, Peter Vlanders, who we know doesn't take a backward step. Once he makes a decision, he goes full throttle. He's copped a lot of flack over it. But even Steve Mortimer, one of the NRL greats, he's suffering from dementia now in retirement, and he has been on the phone to Peter Vlanders saying, go hard at this. Do not take a backward step, because I don't want future players ending up like I am now. And, talking to Brett about it, he said, poor old Steve, like, he's probably in the first stages of what my dad went through. And Polly, it was a 20-year struggle. He really, really suffered with it, So, and it's not just about the height, the big concussions either. It's about the subconcussive knocks over a long period of time that can do the damage.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because Peter Vlanders has copped it, and Rugby League, the administrators have copped a lot of stick this year because we have seen a lot of players rubbed out.
Yep.
And they missed Origin a couple of weeks ago.
And then there was the concern that players were going to be milking it to try and get the another set of six and have the players sin binned. But I think that they've overcome that. You're going to have those instances, but I think even people like Craig Bellamy, the Melbourne Storm, highly successful coach, what absolutely endorses what they're doing, probably just thinks they should have done it at the start of the year. And I sort of tend to agree, changing things midstream, mid-season,
you can't do it now. It's
difficult. But I think the AFL, I'm expecting a statement tonight, and we'll be seeing it ongoing for the remainder of this season.
Yeah. And do you think that if you bring in a rule like that, it would see them change their techniques, tackling techniques,
100%.
Stuff like that?
I think you would definitely have to change their techniques. And also, I think you'll find that acceleration at your opponent, you'll stop, prop and tackle. You'll take that choice rather than go head on into them. We saw it earlier in the season with Patrick Dangerfield. Those sorts of collisions, I think you'll see less of them. And, I was even talking to my young fella this morning. You've got to weigh up. People are saying it's going to change the fabric of the game. But if you reduce head injuries by 50%, isn't that a good thing?
Good change.
It is a good change. Yeah.
Not to mention that you're also preventing some of the best players in the game from being rubbed out through either suspension or through injury.
So we know so much more now about collision and head impact and head trauma. It would be absolutely stupid of us not to act on it. We didn't have this information 20, 30 years ago when it was a different game. It's still a man's game. Still takes a lot of bravery to go out there and run with the flight of the footy and take a mark with a flight of the footy. We're not saying stop that. It's just those those accidental head contacts when it's a loose ball, I think we've got to rub out.
Well, let's talk about some actual footy now, because even though our teams aren't playing, I do believe there are some others that are.
Well, Luke Shuey's playing. One of the things we'll be watching this weekend is Luke Shuey running out for West Coast Reserves, West Coast in the Waffle. So a lot of interest in that. He'll be welcome back.
He's been doing a lot of stretching before the game, right?
Please. We've all got our fingers
warming
and toes crossed
all those soft tissues.
The really fascinating one is tomorrow night, 2v3 Geelong v Western Bulldogs. Of course, a Victorian regional centre Geelong, and they're allowing 7,000 into that ground. To be honest, it'll make a difference, but I think you could have no people at that ground and it will still make a difference, because Cadinia Park is long and narrow. So teams are denied space. So Geelong plays it so well, very hard to win there for that reason. And I think the Western Bulldogs play a brand that they like to flick the footy around a fair bit. And if Geelong can cut off the corridor movement, they're just going to get pushed to wide. And you end up kicking a lot out on the full. And it's a really hard ground to play. So I'd be picking Geelong tomorrow night. It's going to be a really interesting game. I picked the Dogs pre-season to win the flag. But Geelong are just humming along at the moment without doing anything special, and they're right up there at the pointy end.
And how do you think the bye impacts our team? Do they
couldn't have come at a better time. Yeah. I think Adam Simpson would have preferred it to come last week. But they managed to get through in a really, obviously, one of the great wins over Richmond last
Sunday. It took a bit of momentum into the bye.
Oh, it does. And I think in a perfect world, he would have preferred the bye last week, but it could not have come at a better time for both teams. And we've seen already teams coming off the bye. Hawthorn was a great example last week with Sydney with a surprise win. So they'll freshen up, they'll get players back, and West Coast will be building into somewhere near full strength after the bye. Of course, on Sunday, Willie Rioli can return to training with West Coast too. So there'll be a few of us in the media down there.
I reckon a few cameras.
I'm tipping we may not be allowed in. I'm not sure. We'll wait and see with that one. But Mineral Resources Park on Sunday is going to be a very interesting place to be.
And when are we likely to see Willie back on the pitch?
I think August 20 is the date. But I think that's when he can play again. So what do they do? Do they give him one? Do they give him two games in the Waffle? Does he come straight into the AFL team? I think if he's got the load, I would be putting him straight in. But I think what they'll do is they'll give him a game or two in the Waffle.
Just see how he goes.
You forget how good a player he is and how good a distributor.
We haven't seen him for a couple of years.
That mid-forward connection, his distribution of the footy is so good.
Yeah. And let's talk basketball. Wildcats, Bryce Cotton, MVP.
Third time for him. I think he's one of four or five players to do it twice. He's missed the last five or six games, and he's won by an absolute length of the straight. So it just shows you how good a player Bryce Cotton is. Trevor Gleeson picked up the Coach of the Year award. Now, second time he's picked it up, but the first time was with Townsville way back when. Interestingly, five titles he's won with the Perth Wildcats, and it's only his first Coach of the Year, so probably well overdue. So good to see. First game tomorrow night, first game of five in the grand final series. So they're playing Melbourne United. Melbourne finished higher, so they get the last three games. Wildcats are the first two. Got to win them both and then try and jag one on the road. Certainly if it's a 1-1 split, it's going to be very hard from there. But I'll tell you what, you wouldn't write them off, the Wildcats.
If they get both, can you imagine? If they go over to Melbourne with a 2-0 head start, the pressure goes straight back onto United. You couldn't afford to drop one out of three.
No.
It's big advantage.
It is.
So it's one of the rare cases of COVID actually working in our favour.
Yeah, they've done really well. I mean, losing a player of Bryce Cotton's calibre, now I know it's a T and you play to a system, but a player of his ability, very hard to replace. So they've been working their way through it. You saw the first loss against Illawarra at home, and then they were able to win two to get that semi-final series. So they've done a great job, the Wildcats. They're up against it. But you would never write off this franchise because they are a winning franchise.
Yep, they know how to do it. And Trevor Gleeson, the coach, knows what to do. So, and I think they're all pulling together in the absence of Bryce Cotton. Wish them all the best.
Yep, absolutely.
The Red Army will be cheering them along.
They will.
The whole way. Quarters, thanks for joining us. You're recording a potty this afternoon.
Skeeter and I will be in Duff's absence. So a lot to talk about, particularly that McKay tribunal hearing tonight. So a lot to talk about.
Yeah. So anyone who loves footy, you can find that podcast wherever you normally get your podcasts. Check it out when you get a chance. Quarters, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure,
we'll talk to you next
always.
Week. Now, a lot of people don't understand the role that local government plays in their everyday lives. It often comes down to the little things that make us happy in life, and these little details are different for each person. You might think councils just deal with bins, roads, and footpaths, but I want to highlight the role councils play in establishing and caring for everything residents love about their suburbs, such as libraries, youth centres, recreation centres, outdoor play spaces, exercise areas, and parks. And Walga is looking for those unique local government happy places you find within your local community, and you have the chance to share your story and win on TV. It might be a fitness class at your local recreation centre, the council family fun day, or concerts in the park, or learning about worm farming at the local eco centre. Go online to www.walga.asn.au/happyplace and submit a photo or video with your council happy place story to be in the running to win a Canon DSLR camera and star in a Happy Place TV commercial.
The Wild West.
Joining me now in the Wild West is the wonderful Kate Ryan. Hello, Kate.
Good morning.
Now, I've just watched you jump from the producer's chair into the studio.
Yeah, it's
very
been
impressive.
A bit of a frantic morning, but
it has been. It has been one of those days. And now, look, not as frantic as this ambitious challenge that this Australian man has taken on.
Yeah, so Sydney man, Josh Eastwell, he has a pretty ambitious plan to have a snag at every Bunnings in the country. And he's actually done pretty well so far. He's downed 172 of the 280 on offer so far.
So that's what there is, 280 Bunnings.
Yeah, around the country. So, I mean, he's just gone through WA and done some of the even remote sausage sizzles, and New South Wales and Queensland are next on his list.
Wow. It's really quite amazing. I noticed this story go up and people were adding a lot of comments saying, oh, yeah, what a legend, what a legend. And then someone said, you know, like, why is he doing it? Is he raising money for charity? And apparently he's not.
No, he's just doing it.
Just doing it for fun. So that's a bit of a shame. It is a shame that he's not, you know, doing it as an opportunity to raise awareness for, you know, mental health, say, for example. Because I tell you what, my mental health certainly is a lot improved once I go and have a snag in a bun.
Oh, absolutely. As soon as you see that they've got that little tent up at Bunnings, you just, even if you're not going into Bunnings, you just kind of go, oh, yeah, I could have one. And, you know, if it's like a small little, you know, soccer club or something, then you go, oh, I'm doing my bit as well. So,
but how would this bloke feel? He's driven all the way to some remote Bunnings in some town in regional Victoria.
Yeah.
And then he gets there. And on that particular day, the netball team didn't get around to organising the sausage sizzle.
Oh, so
he has to come back the next weekend.
Yeah,
it could take him a while.
Yeah.
It could take him quite a while. And now from one person to another, a Carnarvon local has uncovered, what would you call it, a historical item?
Yeah,
like what you might find with this ancient Greece exhibition at the WA Museum.
I mean, to find a full six-pack of Emu Export unopened from 1989, I think that is a pretty rare find.
Hang on, 1989 was certainly like more than 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it is rare, especially to find them full.
We've got some pictures right there. Let me have a look.
Yeah.
So they look pretty crusty. Oh, it's got the date on the bottom of the can. Yeah, yeah. What does the can itself look like?
Is it the old design?
Oh, yeah, look at that. That is the classic bush chook can right there. I'm surprised. Is it aluminium? It looks like it is. I thought they might have even been steel cans back then.
Yeah. So this bloke, Mark Smith, I mean, he's been metal detecting for more than 20 years. I reckon to date this would be his best find.
And does he said if he's going to drink them?
I don't know.
Have you ever drunk an old beer?
No.
So I did once. I was visiting the in-laws of a girl that I was dating many years ago. And look, let's just say I don't think that they were overly chuffed at their daughter's choice of boyfriend. And so the dad has brought me out this beer, this Heineken that he found under the stairs. I saw him go under the stairs to grab it. And firstly, it was room temperature.
Oh.
And so it's like he'd been saving it for a special occasion.
For a
special someone. And that special someone turned out to be me. And so it was dusty, which was a red flag straight away. And then he's cracked the top of this Heineken and poured it into a glass, and I could see that when the sort of the head settled, the top half of the glass, the top half of the beer was clear like water, and the bottom half was just all brown sediment.
Oh, did you drink it?
I said to him, oh, I haven't seen a beer look like that before. And he goes, she'll be right, mate. Just give it a stir.
Oh, how did it taste?
Pretty rough. That was pretty hard to get through.
Did you have to finish it and
yeah,
kind of go?
Yeah, of course. Mm, yeah, I did. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Thanks
so for that. This Mark guy, this Mark Smith, unfortunately the cans had pinholes in them, so he didn't actually get to try.
Oh, so they're empty?
Yeah, they're empty, even though the tops weren't cracked.
Oh, probably for the best, because I could almost guarantee they'd be pretty gross by now. Oh, Kate Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on The West Live. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Ben.
Well, that's it from me today. You can catch us live tomorrow morning when we return to thewest.com.au in Perth now at 8:45 a.m. And you can stream the full show whenever you want by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea, brought to you by the WA Local Government Association. What's your happy place? If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.